Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. State Representatives Penelope Cernoglou, an East Lansing Democrat, and Christian Grant, a Grand Rapids Democrat, join MERS for a legislative roundtable. They discuss why Democrats are continuing to focus on abortion and reproductive issues this election cycle, although former President Donald Trump has not endorsed a federal abortion ban proposal. Should Michigan drop the state's gas tax in exchange for charging drivers a mileage-based user fee? Chief Executive Officer Denise Donahue and Deputy Director Ed Noyola of the Michigan County Road Association explain why they want the legislature to consider the mileage-based user fee idea this year. President Vanessa Kiesler of Launch Michigan, a public education reform group, describes a new dashboard her organization created comparing Michigan school districts to their counterparts in states that perform highly in education. Now, here's MERS podcast host, Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. It is officially the week of the Great North American Eclipse. We are recording our roundtable conversation around 10 a.m. on Monday, April 8th, the day of the total solar eclipse, and I have not acquired my eclipse glasses yet for the big day. So the second I wrap things up, I'm going to be sprinting to the Harrison Township Library and quite literally praying that there are some eclipse glasses left. Now, let's get down to business. We are warming things up with a legislative roundtable and are joined by State Representative Penelope Cernoglou, an East Lansing Democrat and chair of the House Elections Committee, and Representative Christian Grant, a Grand Rapids Democrat and chair of the Housing Subcommittee within the House Economic Development and Small Business Committee. Hello, representatives. Happy Eclipse Day.
Hello.
Happy Eclipse Day.
Okay, I have to ask, not to say that this is going to be an eclipse-themed episode. It will not be, but I am excited about it. Do you all have any personal eclipse plans for today?
I will personally be on the highway, and so I'm a little concerned. I hope that my eclipse experience is not too exciting. I hope it's pretty calm.
Well, I as of right now, I'm planning to be in the basement unless I make some time to get some eclipse glasses. And if I do, then I think I'm going to let my cell phone use them and take a picture of it. But we'll see. Maybe I'll change my mind and decide to view it myself. But I'm still thinking about it.
Well, for right now, Representative Grant, I am wishing you the best of luck on your highway journey.
Thank you.
So let's kick off our conversation. We have some national presidential race news. Former President Donald Trump made an abortion-related announcement this morning on his Truth Social media platform, and he did not endorse a nationwide abortion ban proposal. Instead, he said, quote, "The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land." Now, end quote. Now, my question for you all, as Democrats in Michigan who have been concerned of the potential of a national abortion ban following this election cycle, does this announcement tell you that talk on a federal ban should be taken off the table in terms of this year's political rhetoric?
For me, when it comes to abortion, when it comes to women's rights, when it comes to rights for people of color, I have to take Donald Trump at his word and what his track record says. And, you know, his track record says that he's going to do everything that he can to remove rights from these certain groups. And I believe that. And I think that we have to take that very seriously. You know, we know that he's on the campaign trail. And so rallying people at the state level right now is really helpful to him, right? So getting people really riled up about making sure that their state, that they're turning out because they have the threat of something at their state level. So that's what works for him today. Tomorrow, he might be saying something different, but I think the message is always the same. He's going to do what he can to take away our rights, and we can't allow that.
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump is responsible for the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. He knew what he was doing then, and he knows what he's doing now. He knows that, you know, nationwide, people support choice, and that's very popular. So he's not going to say like I'm against that. I'm for 100% abortion ban. He's trying to make it sound like there's some flexibility there. But there's not, and I will not support anyone who is not 100% pro-choice. And it's a dangerous place, for him to put us. In Michigan, we're going to do everything we can to protect our reproductive freedoms, but other states, may not be in that same position. And as a nation, we have to protect those freedoms. They are absolutely crucial going forward. And I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later today, but reproductive freedom means a lot of things beyond abortion. It means contraception. It means IVF. It means the ability to start a family, which is something that is near and dear to my own heart. And we can't have politicians like Trump making those decisions for us. I mean, it's our own bodies, it's our own access to medical assistance, and we can't let someone be our president who is going to take those freedoms away from us.
And just to confirm, you two are both on the re-election trail right now, right?
Yes.
So now that you're talking to individuals that are potential voters for the 2024 election cycle, what are kind of the core issues that you really want to talk about as a re-election candidate?
So for me, my constituents are really interested in talking about some basic fundamentals, right? Housing is a really pertinent and desperate issue right now for people all across the state. They want to talk about resources. We haven't defined this as a recession that we're experiencing, but across the board, people at all income levels are feeling really a pinch on the resources that they have available to them. So they want to know how we feel about it and what we're going to do about it. This year was the year where Donald Trump's tax plan really went into effect for some of our lower income families. So each year, over the past 3 to 4 years, we've been seeing the gradual implementation of that program. It started at people with higher income levels, not rich, but just higher. But this year it hit the most vulnerable of Americans, and they're not seeing the tax returns that they're used to seeing. They rely on those things for their basic necessities, how they're paying rent throughout the year, how they're taking care of car issues and unpaid utilities. And they didn't get that boost this year. And so people want to talk about the basics and what we're doing and providing for them.
I apologize. I'm a little bit rusty. What was that tax plan?
I'm not going to quote exact numbers here, but essentially, he gave billionaires and large corporations a huge tax cut. And he did that by levying higher taxes on the regular household, the regular individuals, right? And so it started around like $250,000 to $300,000 households, which, is more than a lot of people make, but is not a huge amount depending on the size of your family. And so it started there and it's gone down to different income levels. I believe they ranked it in four different levels. And so this year it hit like the $40,000 to $50,000, income level, which is a lot of Americans and a lot of Michiganders. And so they're really feeling that pinch. And a lot of people don't know or aren't realizing that that was his plan, right? They heard things right in the beginning when that plan was rolled out, but they didn't understand that it was rolled out incrementally. And so this year they're just like, why aren't we feeling the boost that we usually feel? And some people are attributing things in the economy to Biden. But what we have to understand is that things at the federal level take time, and we're just now feeling that impact.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Representative Grant on all of that. Housing definitely, and cost of housing, is an issue that I hear about. I kind of hear about a lot of different issues, but really, I mean, same basic concept. They want good jobs. They want a good environment to raise their children. They want good schools, and I mean, good health care, really. I've been hearing a lot about mental health parity has come up many times in getting increased access to mental health care in addition to physical health care. That's come up numerous times in a lot of different places. And I mean, I continue to hear from constituents about gun safety. That's always in making our schools safer for our kids. That's a continuing issue as we go forward through all of this. So I would agree. It's just the basics. People want good schools, good health care, good jobs, good quality of life. And I know that everything I'm working on goes towards doing that. And I also hear a good amount about, probably because I work on elections, a lot of about increased access to voting and democracy. People want to know that they're being represented.
Representative Grant, I do just have one more question because you did bring up tax policy on the federal level. Couldn't someone also make the argument that if we care about giving Michiganders more of that tax reimbursement boost or allowing them to keep more of that money in their pockets, maybe legislators should create a policy this year that keeps that 4.25 to 4.05% tax reduction permanent, that 1 year automatic rollback? Why can't there be something like that done on the state level?
I'm so glad you asked. Well, no, I think that would be actually a really poor argument, but I'll say why. That tax rollback only equates to, I think it's $50 to $100 over the year per household. It's a very, very small boost at the household level. But what it does is it takes away, Penelope, correct me if I'm wrong, was it $400 million a year? $400 million a year or more that it takes away from the state budget. And
That
those dollars
sounds right.
are used for programming such as childcare assistance and Medicare and Medicaid and other supports that our most vulnerable families need to be able to have access to. And so at the end of the day, if you ask a family, do you want me to decrease your access to state-supported daycare, healthcare, other things, or do you want $100? They want the supports that they need that will cost them a lot more. So that rollback and talking about that being a tax break for families is really a farce and it's really a joke because it is taking away from resources from programs that are really needed.
Happy Eclipse Day, everybody. We're talking about all the subjects. No shortage of subjects for our legislative roundtable. Let's do a quick little pivot since we did kick off the conversation on the reproductive freedom issue. Last week, the governor did sign legislation eliminating Michigan's criminal ban on surrogacy contracts for compensation. My question is, what happens next when it comes to Democratic leaders and the vast reproductive freedom subject? Do you personally have a dream policy or project when it comes to this topic in Michigan specifically? And I'll start with you, Representative Cernoglou.
Sure. So I'll answer both of those questions kind of differently. It's my understanding that right now we have some legislation coming through to expand access to contraceptives, so birth control. We have some bills that address allowing pharmacists to make prescriptions for birth control so that and require that insurance cover those prescriptions so that when individuals aren't able to get to the doctor, don't have access to a doctor to do that, they can get those prescriptions through the pharmacist. And also some legislation allowing for a 12-month supply to be picked up at the same time, rather than having to come monthly. Anyone who has been on birth control and had to go each month can remember that time when you just didn't make it, or the pharmacy just couldn't fill it that day, and you had to miss it. So that will be incredibly helpful in expanding access to oral contraceptives, and that those bills are coming through our health policy committee right now, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that is going to be the next step in expanding access to reproductive health care. As far as something that I would like to see in the future, since I personally have been a recipient of IVF, I'm an IVF mom. I'm so grateful and feel so blessed to have been able to have IVF successfully. For me, I would like to expand access to IVF. It's not A lot of what goes along with IVF is not covered by insurance, and a lot of families cannot afford IVF and can't get access to IVF right now, which really puts a huge barrier between having children and growing a family. And I would like to see us move forward on expanding access to reproductive health care so that all Michigan citizens can have that opportunity, to be a family, to be a mom or a dad, because to me, being a mom is just it has been the most important thing in my life. And I would like to expand that opportunity to everyone.
It's so interesting to hear these various IVF testimonies with it becoming the topic that Democrats are discussing this election cycle. And I covered a IVF roundtable in the past month, and I had heard a woman say that she initially had gone to an adoption agency, and the adoption agency had told her, "You will have better luck with IVF than you will adopting a child." Is that something that you even encountered in your own experience, Representative?
I can't really speak to that. I did not explore adoption before IVF. For me, we were trying to have a child naturally and found out that it just wasn't working. So started seeing a fertility specialist and kind of went from there. So I didn't I don't have the experience with adoption, so I'm not really sure, but I do know that IVF is very successful now compared to when our parents were younger. I've talked to so many older women who told me they tried IVF time and time again, and it just didn't work from that for them. But now it is becoming increasingly successful, and there's lots of different options out there, including surrogacy now in Michigan, which is it's amazing. But yeah, that I think we should have all of these options open to us.
So I know that we're a little bit over time, but I do just have two specific questions, one for you, Representative Grant, and one for you, Representative Sarah Naglou. And I want to look at your individual leadership roles. So Representative Grant, as the chair of the Housing Subcommittee, I know that you recently had legislation introduced dealing with housing that it says included in the language of the Michigan Planning Enabling Act. So I'm not sure if you're prepared to talk about it, but I am a little bit curious. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so that legislation actually makes some changes to the Planning and Enabling Act. And that act basically outlines the work of planning commissions and master plans across the state. And what we found is that there are a lot of requirements for interest and experience that the planning commission must have, right? Like you must have someone who is interested or knows about education and who knows about zoning and all of these things, but there was not a requirement that the commission had to have housing experience included. And we know that the work of the Planning Commission decides how much housing is available, what type of housing is available in our local communities. And so this legislation just includes that housing in the long list of things that's required. Housing is also a requirement. And it also says that when a community is making their 15 or 20-year master plan, that they should take housing into consideration. They should look at what's the housing need currently, and over the life of that plan, what will be the housing need, and how are we making sure that we provide for that. And I think that it's a really simple bill because it's really necessary. It's what we should be doing already. And I hope that we're starting with just the basic foundation of housing. We're really starting from the ground up here to make sure that Michiganders have the housing that we need. But where I want to see us going, last year in the budget, we put a lot of dollars into, investing in new housing. But what I want to make sure that we're doing as we move forward is really having a conversation about ownership opportunities for Michiganders. We're investing in apartments and townhomes and things all across the state, but are we making sure that Michiganders will have the opportunity to be homeowners if that's what they desire to be? We know that home ownership and property ownership is, it's as American as apple pie, right? It's how Americans build stability and they build wealth for their families. And we have a current generation who feels like they don't have access to that. And so we have to be really intentional about legislation moving forward that is focusing on ownership opportunities for Michiganders.
And with your one legislation dealing with the planning commissions, I mean, would that be a requirement on individual local units of government?
It would, yes.
And now, Representative Cernoglou, elections, you're chair of the Elections Committee. You know, my question for you is, what is a bill you view as most urgent for getting approved ahead of the 2024 general election?
So, unfortunately, I don't think we will have any more bills that are approved ahead of the 2024 elections, because we would have to get immediate effect in the Senate, and that doesn't really happen much for election bills. Elections tend to be highly partisan issues right now, even when our legislation should not be partisan. It just kind of ends up going down that way when we take a vote. But we did do a lot last year, which was you know, which really got us to where we need to be. One thing, you know, if it was possible, that's moving through right now, what we really did want to have in place, but I don't think that it will be, was having a ban on open carry in polling locations, as well as firearms at counting boards. We have been seeing increased rates of threats to election workers over the years, and we did get some legislation in place last year to provide penalties for threatening and harassing election workers. We need to have a lot more election workers this year because of our 9 days of early voting that need to be staffed. So we are hoping that will help. And if there, you know, was one thing I would like to see in place, it would be that ban on open carry, so that people were not feeling intimidated as they enter polling locations to cast their votes. But I, realistically speaking, I don't see much more happening until after the elections take place, because our laws won't go into effect until 90 days after we adjourn.
So just to confirm, that bill did not get immediate effect, the one dealing with open carrying.
So right now, it passed the House, passed the Senate, and it needs to come back to the House for concurrence because there were some amendments and there was not immediate effect.
Now, I know that there's also looks at recount reform, increasing the fees to request a recount of votes in individual precincts. Do you think that probably won't become effective in time to make any difference in the 2024 aftermath of that election cycle?
So I'm not completely sure. Those bills did originate in the Senate. So maybe there were some discussions in the Senate of getting immediate effect. But it's really hard for me to say. But based on what I've seen so far, most bills are just election bills are just not getting immediate effect.
Everybody, that is State Representative Penelope Cernoglou, an East Lansing Democrat, and State Representative Christian Grant, a Grand Rapids Democrat. Thank you both for taking so much time out of your day to join me on the MERS Monday podcast and for discussing such a vast array of topics. I always appreciate when we can do that on this show. And again, I have to say it one more time, happy Eclipse Week.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Our middle segment of the MERS Monday podcast, we are going to discuss a topic that's being circulated as a possible solution to Michigan's reported lack in road and bridge funding, a mileage-based user fee for drivers, which can consist of a user fee drivers pay into either through self-reporting of their mileage or through tracking phone apps or vehicle diagnostic devices. As vehicles become more fuel efficient, transportation and infrastructure groups have expressed concerns that the state's gas tax is no longer being equitably paid into. One of the organizations exploring quote, new ways to sustainably and fairly fund and maintain, end quote, the state's transportation systems is actually the Michigan Department of Transportation itself, which conducted a survey in the beginning of the year on how residents would feel about being charged based on their miles they've driven. We are joined for this episode by Chief Executive Officer Denise Donahue and Deputy Director Ed Noyola of the County Road Association of Michigan, representing the county road agencies responsible for maintaining 75% of the state's centerline miles. Earlier this year, the CRA released a study finding that Michigan must allocate an additional $2.4 billion in funding yearly to restore the county road and bridge networks to modest goals. Could a mileage-based user fee be a solution to this? Well, first off, hello, Ed and Denise. Thank you so much for joining me on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Yeah, hello. So let's just start from the very beginning. How did your road association came across this idea? And what exactly are you doing with this idea?
So we started looking at, we're getting a lot of calls from our members, probably really hit a fever pitch a couple of years ago, where, you know, it was in the news so much, the auto manufacturers were switching to all electric vehicles. We'd had discussions about this before, and road commissions need a long-term sustainable funding source that they can rely on. They are planning things 5 years ahead of time, longer than that, in terms of bridges and how, you know, the order in which they're going to do things and how the townships are going to partner with them. And so they need to know that the funds are going to be there before they commit to these aggressive schedules. And so we started getting a lot of questions, and our initial comments, frankly, were don't worry, they are thinking about it. We're not sure who they are, but we, you know, just assumed that at the federal level, this would be taken care of. We see the IIJA bill come out, and there's nothing in it about a national mileage-based fee to fund the roads. And so we came to the conclusion, Ed and I and our board of directors, that this is something we need to open the conversation and broaden the conversation with legislators and anyone who will listen. This is the path forward.
While we looked at trying to figure out what are we actually in losing, where is the revenue loss that we think that was going on. So Denise and I and our engineer, Steve Pori, tried to do a little quick math on the back of one of the napkins we were using, and guess what? We're not experts at this. And that's when the board gave us direction to go out and find a consultant to help us make that determination of what kind of revenue are we losing.
This is so interesting to think about, because I was covering the legislature in 2022 when gas prices were reaching record highs, and there was actually conversations about approving legislation that would lower or reduce the gas tax, the state gas tax. And now kind of learning, oh, it turns out that gas tax isn't really efficient. Is that fair to say? I find this to be an interesting change in storytelling, if that's appropriate to say.
I think it's fair. We sort of backed into this, as Ed said, we started first looking at the impact of electric vehicles. And so we have a study about that. We can talk about that in a little bit. But really, the bigger issue that no one has been talking about is increased fuel efficiency of our cars. I think that has crept on us little by little, and without us really realizing it had happened. So, you know, got some metrics here. According to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, in 2010, the combined car light truck miles per gallon was 20. Right now, as we sit here, that same agency is reporting that it's 27 miles per gallon. And they're forecasting the fleet average will be 32 or 33 miles per gallon by 2030. That is a whole lot less gas being sold. And gas tax, of course, is 40% of the Michigan Transportation Fund. So if that is eroding under our feet, that's a big deal. Another data point from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says that in 1994, that's a long time ago, the federal gas tax per mile driven was 9/10 of 1 cent. 25 years later, so that's 2019, that had actually dropped and people were paying less. It was now 8 tenths of a penny. So it's a 15% reduction over those 25 years. So we can assume, for the most part, Michigan gas tax collected mirrors that trend because less gas is being sold. Another data point from the Virginia Department of Transportation, they have a report that said from 2019 to 2030, they were predicting as much as 25% less gas will be sold. And so that really hits at the heart of the fuel efficiency, and we just have not been talking about that.
Now, when it comes to the mileage user fee charge, is that is something that your organization is advocating for? Is it just something that you're researching at this point? What is your role? What is your relationship with this idea?
That is something that we need to present to the legislature, and hopefully they will come to that conclusion when it comes to fairness. There's no reason that your older vehicles with less fuel efficiency, your larger vehicles, your pickup trucks and SUVs should be carrying the burden for those higher efficiency newer vehicles and the electric vehicle, hybrid electric vehicles. That this is more of a fairness concept than it is hurting one industry or one type of vehicle over another. This is just, let's all get on the same page and pay a fair amount across the board.
They call it restoring the link between the use of the road system and what people are paying for the road system based on your miles, not the type of vehicle you select, perhaps because of the distance you drive, your budget, et cetera.
Okay, so for yourself personally, and you could separate yourself away from the organization and just talk as your own individual. I mean, what do you imagine the ideal, I mean, do I say tracking device? How do you imagine the ideal system to look like?
We would love to talk about that. So, I mean, one of my jobs is going around the state. Our members at the 83 county road agencies get together 4 times a year and kind of network, and we go and talk about what's going on, and we listen to them. So we've been talking to them for 2 years now about a mileage-based user fee. Whether that is to account for electric vehicles, and now really, you know, talking about the issue of fuel efficiency and the losses that were happening. And so so I got a good feel. You know, we see probably, you know, 1,000 people a year that we're communicating with on a regular basis. We got a pretty good feel for what the average member of the public is thinking. Their road commissioners, their finance people, operations people. And so I think, you know, let's take on that elephant in the room, which is privacy. And it's a question that you're asking, Samantha. How do we want to report our miles driven? And states that are further down the road, so to speak, than we are with MBOF are saying you've got to give people choices as to how this is reported. So, you know, it can be self-reporting, could be a phone app. Could be this OBD2 device, which is something that hooks into that diagnostic cable that hangs under your steering wheel. Could be some kind of telematic device from your car that is automatically reported. Pay a premium and never report your miles. So I'm going to pay the premium. I don't feel like reporting my miles. I don't know. Ed, what's your...
I prefer to report my miles, but I'd also like a little assistance just to make sure that I'm reporting my miles. I don't want to be caught at the end of my useful life of my vehicle and I trade it in and I find out that the miles driven were not reported accurately and I owe a big bill at before I can get the cabs for my new vehicle. And what I'm getting at is the intermediate part of that, when I get my oil changed, when I go get my car to be worked on, they always ask you, what's the miles on your vehicle? Or they'll go in there and pull the miles down on your vehicle. And that should be reported to whoever, whatever state agency or third-party agency is going to be keeping track of miles driven. No, I would prefer that.
I was going to ask if you were like tracking, if you were reporting them yourself, I feel like a lot of people could bend the truth a little bit. Like, did I actually take that road trip up north?
Yeah.
You know, so I can't help but feel like, not to say that there would be bad actors, but I can't help but wonder that there could be a window for some bad acting.
So we went to a national MBOF conference in D.C. and Washington, and there was a lot of discussion about that. How much do we all cheat? They called it leakage. I think that some of the other states, Oregon, some of the other states that are further down this path. It might not be as big of an issue as you think because, you know, we do have odometer reporting in Michigan when you sell your car, but that's something the legislature is going to have to decide what are, you know, should Michigan go down this path? And we probably have to. What reporting mechanisms would they like to use? And you know, there's a cost in collecting that information. And so it all has to be looked at. The good news is there's companies out there that study and model these things that we could work with.
Then your generation probably would be more comfortable putting a phone app on that would download and to your phone, and you could send it from your phone to whatever agency is keeping track of mileage driven.
We think that maybe people our age have read George Orwell's 1984 too many times. But, you know, I go around state. I have a cute little story that when I go to our meetings that I'm talking about, I take my cell phone and I talk about a time during the pandemic when I was complaining to my husband, like my trench coat, the pockets were ripped out. So like my money was falling on the ground. It was faded. I said, geez, I look terrible. I got to get a new coat. I got to be able to go to the store. And within 10 minutes, my phone is popping up ads for trench coats, right? And when I tell that story around the state, all of our people just chuckle because everybody knows that's true. Everybody's had something like that happen. And we don't maybe like that our phones are tracking us, but yet we know that they are. So anyway, so that's sort of the privacy issue. I mean, there are some other issues, concerns that people would have about this system that we could talk about if you like.
Well, I mean, I also am just kind of curious about how did the conversations go when you talk to individual members? Do people sound really excited about this, or are they kind of like, big brother, stay out of here?
They are worried about big brother, but at the end of the day, like Denise was saying earlier, after we talk to them and explain some of the options that they could have and their way, whatever the comfortable level that is for them, that's always comforting to them to know that. And I think there have been some studies to show as you progress in the education process, in the pilot program, you will notice that the concern about privacy goes way down, literally. So the education process of the pilot program is key to the success of this. And I think we can handle that pretty well. And I think our members are much, much more comfortable with the concept of reporting miles.
The Eastern Transportation Coalition, which is the coalition of 19 states that are, some are doing MBUF, experimenting with MBUF, said that, you know, you have an option. One of the really great ways to educate people is that I would sign up and I would get a statement maybe every quarter that shows me how much in gas tax I would have paid based on a mileage-based user versus what I pay in gas tax. And that has taken, when people get those kind of side-by-side comparisons for a year, their concern about mileage-based drops in half. Maybe that's less about privacy and more about what will this really cost me?
Now, would this be exclusively for residents of the state? And what happens when people travel from out of state and enter Michigan?
We've discussed that too, and so did the coalition down in D.C. And here's a phrase that they use, and I truly believe in it. And don't let perfection get in the way of the good. The feds are going to have to catch up to the states eventually, and that will sort of resolve itself. But in the meantime, if you're looking at electric vehicles, we would have to be partnering with the utility companies that are providing that energy for them. And they would have to put a mechanism that when you put your charge card in there to pay for the powering of your vehicle, that it would recognize that it is an out-of-state credit card and you will have to be charged a transportation fee. Now, I'm getting way ahead of everything here, but that's a concept that we would have to consider, or other states are considering right now, on how do we collect from those out-of-staters.
Where we are going out-of-state ourselves, that's where maybe the telematics in your car comes in. The vehicle knows my car, every time I pass a different speed sign, my car updates in my heads up to what the speed sign is next to the road. So our vehicles, you know, the newer ones certainly know, or with the telematics can know, with our phone app can know when we're out of state. And those miles then perhaps would not be reported if that's the type of system that somebody chose. So this is all still in its infancy, but we cannot, as Ed said, let the perfect ultimate solution stand in the way of the dialogue and the first steps here in Michigan.
And this would be something that gets eased into, correct? Like, wouldn't there be a period of this being optional for Michigan drivers? And this wouldn't mean that the gas tax is immediately eliminated, correct?
Some states are phasing this in over a 10-year period. Some states are using a shorter time frame, but it just depends on what we're comfortable. If we're ready to go and we want to transition in 5 years, we can do that. But as you transition out of your fuel tax and go into your EMBA, based on year of your vehicle consumption estimates, or you're volunteering, I want to come in regardless of what year my vehicle is. Once you give people that option, then you can start phasing it in and you start removing the fuel tax, and then you just go to a pure mileage-based user fee strategy.
And it's definitely, Samantha, not an and both situation. The gas tax would come off when the mileage-based user fee kicks in. The premium that EV and hybrid drivers are paying right now on their license plate to sort of make up for the difference, presumably the legislature would remove that. We'd still have a license plate fee, but instead of the gas tax, the MBUF would replace that. So it's not an and both tax.
But when you think about things like a vehicle diagnostic device, I mean, would that be something that the state would pay for, or would you have to pay for it as being a driver in the state?
Well, the one I have, I should have brought it down here, but it's just a couple of inches long. It's called OBD2. We bought it off Amazon, I think, for $12, $15, something like that. It was very inexpensive. It has a certain port. Ed has an idea. Could be paid at the oil change.
Right. And again, that mechanism is just downloading the miles, which would probably download it to your phone so that you could have it and have it recorded and reported as you see fit. Or it could go directly to, like I said, that third party agency or whatever state agency might be required to keep track of our miles.
So if you ask my parents, sometimes I can be a bit notorious slow when it comes to getting my oil changed. Do you think if you had the people taking your oil change as the ones responsible for reporting this, do you think people will go to get their oil changed faster or slower?
Might start doing the using the YouTube and changing it at home. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, if your parents are any around my age, I want my oil changed. I it's a religion. You got to change your oils if you want to keep that car around for any length of time. If you don't, hey, pay me now, pay me later.
So, I mean, what we're highlighting here is there are options, I think, that Michigan needs to work through. When we went to DC, there were over 12 or 15 states there, and they were all very clear that the public would not accept this type of transition to next generation road funding without choice, without education. I think another thing that comes up a lot is rural people saying, we will pay more. I hear that all the time when I go around the state. And quite frankly, it was mind-bending for Ed and I when we first realized exactly what mileage base meant. And it doesn't have anything to do with the F-150 pickup, which practically everybody at Road Commission drives because they got to get to work no matter what. You know, that car doesn't get as good of mileage compared to, let's just say, a brand new, something that's small. And for them to really wrap their heads around the fact that per mile, it's suddenly fair again. You know, they're still driving more miles in places like the Upper Peninsula, might drive an hour to get to your kid's basketball game or more because it's more sparsely populated. But that's really, you know, a lifestyle choice, chosen, you know, to live there. And they're already feeling that now. But nonetheless, instead of it becoming a regressive tax, which is where we are right now with the fuel tax in Michigan, is a regressive tax on older cars. Rural dwellers are bearing more and more of the cost to restore our roads. And because of the fuel efficiency, that's just why we can't get ahead here.
So I have two more questions. I think my first one is, have you talked to MDOT about how their study went, how their survey went in the beginning of the year?
Well, we did. Because interestingly, when we were in DC in October, the vendor came running up to us when we introduced ourselves and said, hey, we're working on this study for the Michigan Department of Transportation. And we actually haven't known a lot about it. It is MDOT's Office of Passenger Transit. Really the first public discussion They call it road usage charge, same thing. First public discussion of that. I think what they said is over 20,000 responses to their poll in about 48 hours. So overwhelming interest. People, I don't know that everybody was like, yay, let's run in this direction, but it was the first exposure really by a lot of people in talking about the concept at all. It's our understanding. We were able to look at the survey questions we got with MDOT right around Thanksgiving, looked at all the survey questions, looked at the video. We have a coalition that is called the Coalition on Electric Vehicles and Road Revenue. So we got together again with MDOT in December, went through that study and the video again. So yeah, we're very familiar with it. It really is largely a marketing study to identify, help them get more data on the future of transit. How many buses will they need? Electric buses, all of that kind of stuff going into the future. But it did a great job in raising awareness of mileage-based user fees going forward.
So why did you choose to support and to be promoting this idea of a mileage-based user fee? Why did you choose this over toll roads?
Well, toll roads are really more for highway use or more applicable to highways. That's what toll roads will do. The problem with toll roads is that it doesn't benefit the local system. It benefits or it takes miles off of the MDOT system because there's an individual third-party agency that's going to be doing the toll road highway, miles of highways. So that generally takes those miles off of MDOT's responsibility and leaves it on the toll road responsibility. The problem with that too is that, as you well know, sometimes you don't want to pay the toll. So you'll go off and use the local road system in order to get to your destination, as opposed to your usual highway system that's now turned into a toll road system. So that's the challenge with toll roads. We as local agencies are not really set up for that type of option, to be honest.
Too many intersections. So if it works for freeways, highways, Michigan Department of Transportation, I mean, obviously we've been all over the HNTB study. We've met with HNTB. It really doesn't do anything for county roads. And of course, that's 75% of the roads and the majority of the bridges. So I'm not against it. It just doesn't fix our issue.
Okay, well, let's tap into Michigander road rage for our final time moments
ouch,
together.
Ouch.
What do you think would piss off a Michigander driver more? Driving on a Michigan highway and seeing a toll road, or having to put a mileage tracking app on their phone?
Well, now, first, I'm just going to hedge, take the easy out here because, you know, I don't know, maybe that's who I am. But to say nobody will, that we've talked with in other states, nobody has to put a tracking app on their phone. Again, places you can pay a premium and not have to do any of the tracking, self-report. So I'm not willing to speculate about which one would piss people off more. Ed?
I'm not going there. Thank you for the question, though.
Oh, my goodness. Well, everybody, that is Chief Executive Officer Denise Donahue and Deputy Director Ed Noyola of the County Road Association of Michigan. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk about this interesting topic.
Samantha, I hope to talk to you again. Thank you.
Anytime. Thank you. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Beep, 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 yeah.
For our final segment of the MERS Monday podcast, I am joined by Vanessa Kiesler, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Launch Michigan, an organization dedicated to seeing Michigan's public education system revamped. Before spearheading Launch Michigan, Vanessa was previously a senior project director for the AEM Corporation, dealing with the management of national education data and assisting the U.S. Department of Education. Recently, Launch Michigan rolled out its own K-12 school district comparison dashboard that additionally compares Michigan school districts with similar districts in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Utah, and other top-performing states when it comes to reading and math proficiency, as well as graduation rates. Some of its opening statewide key findings when you look up this dashboard is that 7 out of 8 Michigan districts do worse than national comparison districts in math, and 70% of districts in Michigan underperformed in reading in comparison to similar districts in top performing states. Hello, Vanessa. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me. Now, let's kick off the conversation. Why did Launch Michigan establish its own dashboard when there's already a state-run education dashboard?
So one of the things that you said is that Launch is dedicated to reimagining Michigan's public education system. And part of our mission is to create urgency for that change. You know, Michigan's education system is still preparing students for the jobs of 50 years ago, not for the jobs of today or, more importantly, tomorrow. One of the things that we know happens is people tend to think of Michigan's education challenges as something happening in some other district or to someone else. So we wanted to get into the data and see how Michigan districts stack up against their peers, their similar districts in top performing states, because that's who we're competing against. That's who our kids are competing against, not kids coming out of like low performing states, but it's a national, it's a global competition. So we started actually with an analysis. We pulled together national data, publicly available national data, and looked at the statewide results. And then we knew people would want to be able to look up their own district, so we created the dashboard. However, it does not duplicate anything that's available in the state dashboard. So Parent Dashboard for School Transparency, that is hosted by the Michigan Department of Education, is a school-level dashboard. Ours is district. Their dashboard allows for comparisons within the state. Ours is only comparisons to other states. And we have a more focused number of metrics where the parent dashboard has really a large and wonderful volume of data available. So we see them as complementary to each other.
So what did you find most alarming out of this report when it came to your key findings?
So I think, you know, we know that Michigan's education system didn't get to where it is overnight. It's been decades of Band-Aid fixes, been a lack of investment. And we know from the national, the aggregate statistics, that Michigan is low ranked in some other metrics. Even given that, when we found each Michigan district's peers, so they're most similar districts based on like demographics and size, I was alarmed to see just how many Michigan districts underperform their peers. So like you said, 7 out of 8 Michigan districts performing worse than their peers in top performing states in math, and 7 out of 10 performing worse in reading. That's alarming. You know, that really underscores our need to reinvent our system.
So when you think about the states that you use for comparison purposes, like Utah, Virginia, Massachusetts, I mean, what do you think is like the big thing that they got right in their education formula where they were able to skyrocket into these top performing seats?
What we know about top performing states is actually what's reflected in the Launch Michigan framework and also in the Growing Michigan Together Council PK-12 recommendations that just came out recently. So top performing states like these have aligned governance. So they have leadership that's aligned from the governor through the state superintendent down through the districts or regional support agencies. They have people going in the same direction around education. Michigan has a more disjointed model where, you know, the governor puts out her priorities, the state superintendent puts out his, he reports to the state board. So that's something we do differently and that we'd like to change. Other states also, top performing states, have a clear understanding of what a meaningful high school diploma is, like what it means to graduate. There's a performance standard there. And Michigan doesn't have that at the same level. We do have some things. We have like our Michigan merit curriculum, we have some data, but there's no understanding of a standard that kids absolutely have to meet in order to graduate. And also no understanding from parents of where their kids are or not on the way, or not as much as there needs to be. That's something these states have. And finally, these states invest in their education system in a way that we have not historically in the last 20 years. Now, I do want to say there have been really important recent investments into the foundation allowance, into educator talent, into some other things by the Whitmer administration. So we appreciate that and applaud that, but we still have to, those are good early results, but we have to keep going.
Yeah, that's something that I've definitely been thinking of as a legislative reporter. I started my career in November 2020 as a full-time journalist, and I've been covering these kind of back-to-back record-breaking first ever highest of its kind education budgets. And I think my question is there a such thing as the golden number when it comes to education funding? Because it seems that a lot of money is getting poured into learning and a lot of money is getting poured into schools. And there is a lot of reform happening, especially last year. But when do you hit that gold star of, hey, education has now been fully funded for?
That's such a good question. I think people have a different number. Different groups have a different number. Launch bases our advocacy for a fully funded system following the State Finance Research Collaborative number, which is about like $3.4 billion additional investment, roughly. But I think beyond the exact number, there's a few other things. We need to make sure that money that is meant for K-12 schools is going to K-12 schools, like it's not getting put toward other things. We need to make sure that we're really paying attention to funding fully special education along with other equity supports in funding. So not every student needs the same things in school, and not every district educates the same students. So again, we've done some work on that as a state with the there are multipliers in the foundation where you get more money to provide different services to different types of kids, but there's a lot of room for us to grow. And we need to be thinking about it's not just more money, it's more money for the right practices. So I think it's less about a magic number and more about continuing the investments, but having those honest conversations about are we investing in the right things and how do we know? So launch also couples investment with this idea of a performance standard and governance so that when you're putting more money into a system, you can be sure it's going to get the outcomes that it needs and that there's this like leadership from the top to the student that is transparent and working toward the outcomes that we need.
So, and this doesn't have to be Michigan specifically. I know that you've done some national work in terms of education data, but what was one time you saw a education appropriation that made you go, oh, seriously, that's not a wise way to improve this? Oh, here's how I'll ask even better. What are your education spending pet peeves?
I think that this is hard, and I think every state has this issue sometimes. So it was not just Michigan, but I've probably seen it the most in Michigan. I think in recent years we've done a better job of this. I think when we don't make sure we know what we're investing in, and the money for education gets put into smaller pet projects that we're not sure how they fit together toward the whole, like how does this help the whole system? Or sometimes competing things are funded. It's like we're going to put money into this set of supports and this set of supports, and they're really like serving the same group of students or teachers. And so now it's almost a competition. I think that just speaks to this need for leadership and aligned leadership in education. Like, what are our main goals? How are we investing in it? How are we funding programming or supports or whatnot to get there? Because even in years recently where Michigan, other states have had more money to put into education, it's still not, it's not an endless well of money. So how do we be strategic and make sure we're putting our money toward the most important things and not kind of losing pieces of it along the way? And then districts and schools are get so exhausted with like 5,000 different initiatives and everybody being like, do our thing, no, do ours, no, do ours. It's very exhausting for them. So it would help them if we could be aligned with our programming.
So when you think about a meaningful high school diploma education, I mean, what is a class or a course or a subject that students aren't getting access to right now that would be really beneficial for them to improve in these areas?
I think there's two things that we need to do around meaningful high school diploma. And again, I'm working to co-create a more detailed answer to this with educators, with superintendents, with teachers. So this is a little bit my thoughts, Launch's thoughts, but some thinking from others in the field. I think it's partly about switching to more of a competency or mastery focused system where kids get to work at more of their own pace and be more engaged, set more of their path. It's still high school, middle school, and high school still too often feel like they did 50 years ago. You take six classes, you sit in desks, you do work, and that is an older model of education. And it's hard to switch. There's a lot of things that make it difficult for districts to do a mastery focus model. There's a group called the Future of Learning Council that Launch is working with, who is doing great work with superintendents to help them figure out how to switch their districts to more of a competency-based education. And the other thing, I think kids need more ways to be engaged and to try out their next step. Like, what are you doing after high school? Are you going to college? Are you going to career? Are you going to trade school? Are you going to, then to career? Are you going to take a gap year? Like, there's a lot of paths, and it's a little bit still too one size fits all. Too many kids either kind of get into an academic track, quote unquote, or CTE. And really, students need to be able to have work experiences and also classes that help them prepare for college in different ways. They need to be able to try things out. So I think it's making a more student-centered approach, especially to high school and middle school. I think elementary does that more already, But to prepare for the jobs of tomorrow, you don't just take a few classes, then you know the things for the jobs of tomorrow, right? You need to practice thinking and being creative and self-driven. And that's hard. School just still isn't set up for that. So it's a big job to reinvent. It's not just pass a law or do a thing or take a course. That's why I'm really encouraged by some of the partnerships that Launch has with educators and really committed to raising their voices up in this conversation so that this policy is done with them and not to them. That too often we do that with policy.
A part of me also wonders, just hearing everything that you illustrated just now, I wonder if another part of the obstacle is, how do you redesign something when you have no thing that is currently in existence to base that new model off of? Like, it almost seems like there is a lot of starting from scratch going on right here when it comes to your vision.
Yeah, there's a lot of districts and schools around the country who have moved to more future thinking models. I think as a state, it's hard to shift. It's also hard because, like, we're educating students right now every day. So you can roll out a new model, and districts do this all the time with new programs or new whatnot, but you still have to have something in place. You know, that's a challenge. And you're right that sometimes we don't know 100% what works. You know, I'm a researcher in my background too, and I know we like to say, well, look at the data and it'll tell us what works. To really get to be able to do like a causal claim and say, like, we are 100% positive that if you do this, like a drug test or whatever, you know, if you take this drug, your headache will go away because we tested it in a trial. You can't do that same kind of test with education. Like, we gave these kids good education and these kids bad, and now we can prove that this is good. Like, it's unethical. You can't do that. So we have to use the evidence that we have, you know, the learning about brain science and student engagement, and make good choices and try things. And it's also why we have to keep at things and course correct. Another big error we make in education policy is we say, here's the policy. We do it for 2 years. Someone's like, it's not working. Give up, start over. That's probably just about when it was like getting mature enough that you could detect a result. You know, you have to give it a minute to work. So to stay the course on some of this, this is a long haul project for us.
As you were constructing this dashboard, especially as a data person, what is a prediction that you had, something you thought you were going to find, but it didn't come true?
I thought you'd be able to see more patterns in the types of districts who underperformed and overperformed. So we did some additional analysis to see, like, is it more rural districts than urban or whatnot? And I was actually surprised to find that there weren't a lot of patterns. Like, these overall results, 7 out of 8 Michigan districts underperforming in math, was fairly consistent when you broke it out by district size or whatnot. So I honestly thought there'd be more, we would be able to say, like, oh, maybe it's like the suburban districts driving this result or whatnot. You can't see that. These results stay pretty shockingly uniform across all, you know, breakouts of different district types.
Yeah. So kind of like struggles were inclusive. That didn't matter if you were a small rural district or a super populated suburban district.
Right. Exactly. That's a great way to say it. And that surprised me, because usually you see overall results, you usually see them be different by different types. And these were less, there was a lot less pattern than I would have expected.
And when did this dashboard come out?
We released it on March 27th. We spent about 8 weeks probably with early stakeholder previews with lots of different, you know, with education groups, with philanthropy, with business. So some people saw it before the 27th, but we released it officially to everybody March 27th.
I really would love to poke your mind at this as a professional. I mean, can I say, like, a professional education data expert who's just been involved in this for so long? I mean, but what is something that is there, you see education data and these results and these studies get plastered onto any type of press release, et cetera, post on Facebook, whatever it might be. Is there anything that you think is a misconception or a mishandling of education data?
Yeah, I love that question. I think the biggest mistake we make with education data, actually, is that we spend a lot of time debating about the data. So no data are perfect, right? They're a representation of real life. They're not perfect. It's hard to capture all the things about what happens in schools or districts. It's hard to measure student achievement. You know, all these things are hard. But we in education have gotten into a space where we spend so much time debating about the precision of the metric. We're like, well, no, it's not exactly that. It's this, or this test isn't exactly right. And then data loses its power. The point of data isn't to get stuck with it and just fight about it and then feel like we did something. data is supposed to point us at some important actions and then take action and then go back to the data to check in and keep taking action. Somebody could find something in this dashboard. They'd be like, well, I wish you would have built the metric that way instead of this way. Like there, people can argue about that, but I hope people can take this and other data. I hope we can move to a place where we're not afraid or we're not debating about the data. And we're like, it tells us it's not the whole story, but it's part of the story. So what's the rest of the story? And more importantly, what are we going to do? Like, let's get moving on action. Let's not get stuck in fighting about which assessment data you used or whatever. I was at the department for the Michigan Department of Education for 10 years, most of those as deputy superintendent over a lot of things, but including assessment accountability. And when I reflect back on those years, that was 2010 to 2020, one of my big takeaways is like, we just fought about the metric all the time. And in the meantime, we weren't using the metric to make improvements or to support schools and districts. Like the support, the so what, that's what was important, not the measurement.
Okay. How long do you think it will take for Michigan to build up its education system to be truly competitive of states that launch Michigan or incorporated into its dashboard for comparison purposes?
Yeah. This is such an important thing for us to be talking about because we can make changes and we should make changes now that can have immediate effect. There's kids in classrooms, there's kids graduating, there's kids moving on to the next grade. So we need to be thinking about what are the changes that can go into effect right away. One that I'm really proud of the state for doing, already before this, all the investments into the educator pipeline. So things like giving student teachers scholarship money so that they can get paid while they're student teaching, and scholarships for people going into the profession. Those are things that are like making an impact on getting kids, people into the education profession right away. So that's been like a couple years, and it will take time. Michigan has been working on improving its literacy rates through our Read by Grade 3 efforts for like 6 or 7 years. And before the pandemic, the scores were starting to trend up. Then the pandemic like made everybody, that was a challenge. So I can't give you a number of years, but I want to say it's important that we don't stop trying. And that's why launch exists, actually. We will be here through changes in administration, changes in legislation. We want to keep pointing the state at that North Star of system level change, governance, career and college ready standard and resources, and not shift focus, not take our foot off the pedal. It's at least a 5-year effort to even get some of these changes like implemented. But in the meantime, we have to look for what we can change about kids in classrooms right now. It's not like we wait 5 years and hope for the best. It's like we're actively changing the system every day.
Everybody, that is Vanessa Kiesler, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Launch Michigan. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join me on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you to everyone who tuned in this week, and thank you so much to the guest who took the time to come on and participate. I would like to express my gratitude to State Representatives Penelope Cerniglu, an East Lansing Democrat, and Christian Grant, a Grand Rapids Democrat, who came on this morning, Monday, April 8th. Also, thank you so much to CEO Denise Donahue and Deputy Director Ed Noyola of the Michigan County Road Association, as well as Vanessa Kiesler, the president of Launch Michigan, who made time for me to interview them on Friday, April 5th. Moreover, huge thanks to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos, which is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber. Also, happy Eclipse Week.